Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires, we're going to take a look back at some of my favorite moments from the first 20 episodes of the show. With so many new listeners, this felt like a good time to go back and highlight moments that you may have missed. Plus, selfishly, it gave me a chance to re-listen to some of my favorite moments as well. It was actually really hard for me to narrow these down, but the episodes I want to focus on today include venture capitalist Bryce Roberts, chef Manit Chauhan, singer-songwriter Lucas Nelson, comedian Gina Yashire, and a diagnosed psychopath named Jamie that changed so much of my own perspective on money, and I am sure that she will do the same for you. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and certified financial planner, and this is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. To kick off this special episode of 50 Fires, there was no way I couldn't include my conversation with Jamie, who asked that we only use her first name. Jamie is a diagnosed psychopath. The way Jamie approaches money has changed the way my wife and I approach money. In fact, I found it so interesting and impactful for me and my wife that I asked my friend Hal Hirschfield to join me in discussing my conversation with Jamie so I could get his perspective. Hal is a renowned academic and a professor of behavioral decision-making and psychology at UCLA's business school. I knew that Hal would find Jamie's approach to money interesting because he focuses so much on the impact that our future selves have on the decisions we make today. Hal, tell me about, because I know you listened to that episode, just like, what stuck out to you? What questions were you left with? And particularly maybe from your work about future self, like what stuck out to you?
Okay, a couple things. One is, I'm fascinated by the way that she said that she was obsessed with compound interest.
I just thought, okay, you know, the best use for money when you're in your early 20s is to just put it in a traditional Roth account, you know, fully maximize it and keep doing that for 5 years, because I was so compelled by the idea of compounding interest. I thought, oh, you know, the easiest way to get $1 million is to just invest basically like $25,000 and just wait 40 years. That's just the easiest way, you know, not to work for it.
Wait, let's just back up. You're so compelled that in your 20s, the best use of money was just to fund your retirement.
Yeah.
Like that is not a sentence I've ever heard anybody say before, right? Obviously it makes sense, but most people say the best use of money in my 20s is to spend it on having a good time, right? Like you're not thinking about that future self. And you're just saying you looked around and said, well, that doesn't make sense.
I guess I thought I was having a good enough time as it was. You know, I already was having a good time. So I just, you know, you're not
26 years old, and that she said, you know, well, the best thing I can do right now is put all my money into retirement. You know, it's like, it's so funny because I always talk to financial advisors who feel like compound interest is magic too. And they say, if I just show people this, they'll start saving. And it's like, it doesn't, you know, okay, that's a cool graph. But, you know, and for her, it was like, this is incredible. Why would I miss this opportunity? And what I loved about that is that, because, you know, I heard you mention, oh, you're doing this thing for your future self. And for her, it was almost like that future self didn't matter. It had nothing to do with the future self in my mind. It was like, there's an opportunity I can take advantage of. And, you know, I think one of the things that she had said was, I mean, she's obviously incredibly self-aware. She had said that thing that, like, she's aware that part of her, you know, personality disorder is impulsivity. And she was worried that, like, she might take a job and lose that job and go to another one and leave that one. And, like, at least this would give her, like, an insurance plan, you know, and a cushion, if you will, if she changed. So, you know, so you could say that and say, oh, that actually demonstrates some empathy for her future self. But I don't actually think that's what was going on there. You know, I think it was like, I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm not inside her head, but it struck me that part of what she was saying was, there's a rational way to do this. And I think she was saying that, like, yes, she will be older in the future. Yes, that's a future self, but it's almost as if, like, she doesn't want to harm herself right now. And, you know, I mean, we could get really into the nitty gritty. Like, is there a, is that self-esteem? Is that like empathy for yourself in the moment? Whatever it is, I do think she possesses that. She like cares about her own outcomes.
Yeah. I thought what I took away from that piece was that there wasn't any emotion attached to either one. It was like she's mentioned in other parts of the conversation, she said she started developing normal people rules.
Yeah. I thought that was great.
So I imagine like a normal person, you know, would they be able to fully fund their retirement by the age that they're 30?
No. The answer to that question is no.
But I think one of the reasons why is because they overthink it, you know, like they, it's on their mind too much. They're not able to disconnect from it, to just do the thing and be done with it. Like right. I am
because I read the thing about compounding. That makes sense. Do the thing.
Yeah. And then just be done with it. And then like never think about it again. And they have done studies about this where, have you ever seen these cartoons where old cartoons, Looney Tunes, they're like escaping from prison usually. And there's a spotlight. And the whole screen's black, like these black and white cartoons, unless the spotlight is on the character and then you can see the character.
Oh, yeah.
And then the spotlight goes to other things and you can't see the character. That's what my attention is like. If the spotlight's on the thing, then okay, I see it, I'm aware of it. That's my tendency. And if the spotlight's not on the thing, then I'm able to compartmentalize it away. You know, it's as if the thing doesn't exist. Now, interestingly, as I have done therapy, I have been less good about compartmentalizing. Like that's become a skill that I've had to kind of actively practice. And so now I have these cheats, normal people cheats, I guess, to achieve the same effect.
Normal people cheats.
Yeah, which is like meditation, mindfulness. And I have like hard rules, super hard rules that I won't do certain things. Like I don't look at my email past like 6 p.m.
What are some of the other normal people cheats?
So other normal people cheats is just kind of like in the moment, you know, let's say I'm going for a walk. It's like, what do I feel on my skin? What do I, you know, like trying to kind of hyper focus in that moment. Whereas before, you know, like when I was like a baby psychopath, that was just the natural way of being, is that I was just very much in the moment. That was like the great thing about being like a young psychopath is you're like hardly concerned about anything. It's just easy to compartmentalize right to the nth degree and just not worry about the future, not worry about the past, like zero worry.
In a way, it's like, it sounds funny because we're like normal people rules and, you know, and she, you know, uses the term psychopath to describe herself in a way that like is jarring to a lot of people, but then you sort of listen to what she means by it and it's a real, you know, real condition. But in some ways, the idea of rules is no different than like, you know, when we talk about our mental models and when we talk about like, you know, creating a habit or whatnot, it's just, we do it with often emotion attached and she doesn't, right? But most likely she's getting a better outcome because emotion doesn't get in the way.
It was interesting. I came home, my wife listened to that episode and said, what are we going to do like Jamie?
Love that.
She's like, are there some decisions we can just make once?
Yeah.
And not be all emotional and connected to them? Like just make it once. Like I almost think of it as too, like the light bulb's out. How many times am I going to think about changing the light bulb?
It's so good.
Like how much energy am I going to waste? How many times am I going to pick up a piece of mail?
Yeah.
Like I've got friends who are like, touch it once, you know, like with their mail rule is touch it once.
It's great.
You know, and I probably pull it from the mailbox and then it sits on the counter and then I do the thing. I would imagine, I mean, just using Jamie as a metaphor a bit here, like, you know, those kind of rules were really impressive to me.
I think it's great. I love that, by the way. That's such a smart rule because I have the same problem as you where it's like goes from the mailbox to the counter to eventually a different counter to finally like a moment of like, oh, we have to clear out the house and get rid of this. You know, but it's funny though, because I've been thinking about this since listening to that conversation of like, what would be the way to apply her way of thinking to my own self? But, you know, but it is, I mean, it's like, it's probably not so easy to just say like, oh, what can I just do once? Because we also have the feelings, you know, I love the part where she said, you know, since going to therapy, she's essentially gotten worse at compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
And that she's had to do like normal people ways of dealing with it, you know, with mindfulness and meditation and whatnot. And I thought that was such a funny thing to say, like, you know, one positive outcome of the psychopathy was being able to like expertly silo everything away. And then she starts feeling things, they bleed over. It's like everybody else, right?
Yeah. Really interesting. Well, thanks for that, Hal.
Totally. No, it was a fascinating conversation. She must have been a trip to talk to.
It was really, really fun, actually. Let's go back to the beginning, to one of my first guests on 50 Fires, venture capitalist and my good friend, Bryce Roberts. As we were developing this show, I wanted to test the concept of having meaningful conversations about money with a few people that I knew and trusted. I met Bryce a few years ago, and he was at the top of my list for this show because I find him super interesting, and we have a lot of things in common. We share a deep sense of craft, which means we both care a lot about the work we do. We're both members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and so, stereotypically, we both have a lot of kids. Bryce happens to also live nearby, which means he enjoys the mountains almost as much as I do. And the part of my conversation with Bryce that I want to share with you involves a chance encounter that Bryce had in the very same mountains.
I remember being on a lift, this is probably 15 years ago now, with a guy. And we were just chatting. What do you do? What do you do? Oh, you know, I basically don't work. Huh, you're like my age. What's the deal? I have a website called dogpoopsacks.com.
Right?
Dogpoopsacks.com makes this guy $250,000 a year. And for him,
what else do you need?
That's all he needs to live the lifestyle he wants to have. For him, the circles he runs in, the community he's with, that's enough. And you tell me, how often in your business, in your financial advising world, in your friendship circles, like, how often do people even use that word enough? And you, last time we talked, presented me with what you called the devil's golden question.
Yeah, yeah. For a little bit of context, there's a cultural sort of teaching that we have that, the devil, however you want to refer to the devil, asked this question of us in modern culture, probably ancient culture too, like as long as it's been going on. And the reason I care so much about this question is it's really pointing to maybe a central tension of the way we live our lives, which is that the crux of the decision around living a life of contentment and happiness, independent of what it says about the next life, like whether you believe in that or not, living a life of contentment and happiness versus a life of constant attachment, constant grasping, constant like trying to get more and more and more, maybe the tension between enough and needing more. The question is, how do you interact with money? How much money do you have? And the answer is, you know, there's only really one answer, and the answer is enough. You know, I have sufficient. I have enough. Yep. And the crux of our contentment in life is, how do you answer the question? Like, do you have enough or do you need more? Like, and the golden question may just be, like, how much money do you have?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, there's like a Ryan Halliday book about, I mean, maybe, you know, he did that whole series, yeah. But there was one line in there that I reflect back on a lot. And I don't remember which of those books it was, but it was basically like, if the question is how much, the answer will always be more.
I can't tell you how many emails or comments I've received about that part of my conversation with Bryce. This idea of figuring out what it means to have enough. And I'm particularly interested in pushing the edges of that discussion. And it may be something that you find really productive to try. Like, what would it mean? Like, just push the edge a bit. Like, you're not going to go do it, but get really extreme about it. To get to the spot where I felt like I had enough. What would I cut out of my life? I think this idea, sometimes we get so wrapped up in the, as I believe Stephen Covey said, the thick of thin things. It's really insightful to just maybe even make it an exercise. Like, what would it mean to push the edges of enough? What are the things that actually matter? What would your life look like if you thought, I have enough? That's what that conversation with Bryce did for me, and I know it's done for so many of you. Up next is my conversation with Chef Manit Chauhan. Manit has some of the best restaurants in Nashville. I know because I just went there. The food was so good. And if you've ever watched the Food Network, you'll recognize Manit as a judge and competitor on shows like Chopped and Tournament of Champions. But before all that, she was born and raised in India. And at a young age, she recognized something about the community she grew up with, a recurring theme that has emerged in a number of my conversations so far on the show, but best illustrated by Manit's story. Do you think, looking back on this, because this is really interesting to me, you mentioned you grew up in, I think you used the term sort of average middle class, but everybody else around you was the same?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that had some role in this idea of not ever feeling like there was something you weren't getting? Like everybody was kind of doing the same. You didn't have a lot of access to, you know, the Kardashians on a plane. You know, you like the Instagram.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I must have been 8 or 9 when we got our first TV, right? Which was this small black and white. And in India, it would only, like, there would be only one show which would come after the news, between the Hindi and the English news. So there wasn't a lot that we were exposed to. What was happening around in our community, that's what was available. And at that time also, India was a closed market. We weren't getting a lot of things coming in from overseas. I remember the first time I spent 50 rupees and got a can of Coke.
You remember that?
I remember that because 50 rupees was a lot, right? And a can of Coke, you couldn't get it in the town that I was, where I grew up. But we never saw cans, right? We only had those bottles and Coke, it was not available in India. So to me, I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting something overseas, like from foreign for my sister, right? And it was like with so much pride, I got it for her. And we did not open that can forever because we were like, you know, this is prized, like this is expensive, it's prized. But it's interesting how the perspective changes.
I want you to notice something. Notice the impact of the community that you surround yourself with in terms of money. It turns out peer pressure is a real thing. And we say silly things like, oh, I would never try to keep up with the Joneses. But the people that you surround yourself with and the messages that you're taking in have a real impact on how you treat money. So one thing you could think about is to be very careful and intentional about curating who you're hanging out with when it comes to money. And by who you're hanging out with, I mainly mean, what messages are you allowing into your life? What do you see on Instagram, right? Because that causes huge problems with our money. And keeping up with the Joneses is not in your face. It's this little insidious problem. You just sort of notice somebody else doing something and then you think, well, why don't I do that too? You often hear people say you become the average of the 4 people you spend the most time with. That's true with money too. We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talkin' Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talkin' Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talkin' Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. The next conversation I want to share with you was a real treat for me, because most of these conversations have been done remotely. This one was in person, and there's something magic about sitting around something you could metaphorically think of as a campfire. It gives you time to reflect and react and have a beautiful conversation. So I was settled in a cozy room at a music and art conference in my hometown of Park City, Utah, and I got the chance to have a conversation with Lucas Nelson, a singer and songwriter whose band is called Promise of the Real. And yeah, his dad happens to be Willie Nelson. The one thing that I've reflected on again and again during my conversation with Lucas was the role that money played in relation to inspiration and creativity. He was really intentional because he had learned lessons. He had been taught from people like his father, Willie Nelson, to be really careful about his money so that he could focus on the thing that he cared most about, and that was to write songs that he was proud of and do it on his own terms.
I understood from learning on my own about finance, learning on my own about contracts that people signed and got screwed, you know, or the idea that when you sign with somebody that you have to, you know, you have to have consistent output of songs, you know, and I never wanted it to become a burden to me. I'd rather make my money playing live than rely on songwriting, because songwriting to me is such a spontaneous event. Mm. It's like an inspiration thing. Mm-hmm. But to make it a living means I don't think you can turn it on and off. And so a lot of times when you try and force a song, right, it becomes off as pedantic or whatever. You can tell it was written and formulaically, and it's like the cosmic gift, right? Right, and right. to just like make it a routine thing, yeah, really seems like
antithetical
to the whole idea. Yeah.
And songwriter. You knew that early. Like you set things up early so you wouldn't have to. Who taught you? Like, what did you?
My dad was the greatest influence in songwriting. I think he's one of the great songwriters of our time. And I learned from him and from watching and listening to music since I was a young kid.
The part about the inspiration.
Yeah. And also the idea that he told me a long time ago, never force to write a song, you know, like Roger Miller said, you got to wait for the rain.
And because it was interesting, I was viewing that largely through the inspiration glasses, like the process of creation.
Yeah.
But you're saying that also had an impact on you in terms of how you set up the business side.
Totally. I didn't want to kill the muse.
Pursuing comedy for a living is actually no laughing matter. It's serious business. And my next guest, Gina Yashire, a British comedian who came to the US and found success as the co-creator of the CBS sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola, comedy became a career that she chose after exhausting all other options of doing something more conventional.
I left engineering. I got a redundancy as an engineer. I worked for Otis, which is the biggest elevator company in the world. So there was a time when the building industry was going through a slump and they were letting people go. They were laying people off. They were never going to lay me off because I look great on the brochures, you know, on their diversity, look at us, we got a woman. So I just marched into my manager's offices and I was like, let me go. I'm done with this job. During that break, I was just enjoying the summer and I fell into doing comedy and I started performing and enjoying performing. And I was like, well, I'm going to see where this goes.
You just fell into it?
I did.
Come on.
As a kid, I was always a class clown. People had always told me I was funny. When I was a child, I remember a drama teacher at school at the parent-teacher conference saying to my mum, your daughter should be a performer of some kind. She should be an actor or something like that. That she should be a performer. And my mum was like, forget this performance nonsense. You're going to be a doctor. So that was the end of that discussion. So I buried those because I was following what my mother said I had to do. But after I'd left engineering, those passions bubbled up. And I was like, oh my gosh, I love this. I became addicted to the laughter. Started doing open mics, and then people started coming to me and saying, oh, I'll give you 10 bucks if you come and do that at my show. And before I knew it, I was a stand-up comic. So that's how I fell into it.
Come on. What a great story. And people paying you to do it.
People paid me to do it.
How did you deal with the expectations of your mom at this point? Because you're no longer an engineer and you're certainly not a doctor.
Yeah. So I told her that I was doing this comedy thing, and she was obviously very not happy about it. But I told her, look, engineering is always there. I'm doing this, and this is what I'm doing right now. And I'm earning a living doing it. And if it doesn't work out, I'm still a qualified engineer. I still have my degree. I can walk into another engineering job tomorrow if need be. I'm still a qualified engineer. You can still boast to your friends in Nigeria that your daughter is a qualified engineer. But this is what I'm doing right now. So she wasn't happy. She was like, you're leaving engineering to become a clown. I don't get it. But within 6 months of getting into comedy, I got on a TV show hosted by a man called Jonathan Ross, who was our version of Leno.
Okay.
So getting on a show hosted by this man, and I'm standing on a stage, and my mother came to the show and is on TV in front of millions of people, then that validated my new career choice. Because like now she's like, oh, she's on the television with famous people. And now I'm on a television with famous people. And it validated everything. So after that, she was completely on board and supportive. And, you know, I started to get more and more successful, and I started to earn money.
It's so interesting. Don't you find it fascinating that when you look at someone else's life and their career, they've been successful, you feel like they must have had it all planned out. Like it was this grand plan and all they had to do was execute it. And if you don't know what you're going to do for a living, you must be lost. In fact, I remember being 35, maybe even my 40s, leaning back in the chair at dinner with my family there and saying, man, I wish I knew what I was going to do when I grow up. So this idea of just sort of playing in traffic, and I love like addicted to the laughter, like noticing what lights you up and then taking the next step. Maybe that's all there is. You know what's crazy, my friends, is that was just 5 of the conversations I've had so far on 50 Fires. There's so much more for you to listen to. You cannot miss, if you haven't heard them yet, my conversation with Chip Gaines, or the terribly uncomfortable things I learned in my conversation with my wife, live on the air in front of you without a net. And trust me, there's a whole bunch more to come. So until next time, cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start 1 million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com, and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start 1 million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.